Have you noticed how different European politicians reacted very differently to the new American government's combative moves? Leaders from the UK, Ukraine, and Poland all had to resort to appeasement. After Trump and his team slapped tariffs on UK's exports, yelled at Zelensky in the White House, and told Poland's foreign minister to, quote, be quiet, small man, each three ended up basically saying that we're sorry, we're very thankful for the US, please be nice to us. In fact, the Polish opposition even went on to suggest that someone should take away the foreign minister's Twitter for daring to upset the Americans. Now, contrast that to French President Emmanuel Macron, who fact-checked Trump and basically told him he was lying in his own White House, and then a few weeks later had a French nuclear submarine sent to Canada, implying that the Canadians might want to consider buying these instead of the US subs they were probably planning on, while shortly after he also convinced Canada's Prime Minister to visit him in Paris as his first foreign trip, where the two called each other reliable allies, unlike, well, you know who. That is decidedly not what appeasement looks like, and it's a set of moves that really only France could have afforded to make. Because as it turns out, they have something that no other American ally has, strategic autonomy, and also a business model they'd very much like to sell us. From military to energy, and even to some extent technology, France has managed to become uniquely independent, while the rest of us allowed us to become existentially reliant on the US. So with the current shift in politics, let's see how the rest of Europe could move towards autonomy in these three areas as well, what we could learn from the French, and also what we might want to do differently from them as well. This video was sponsored by Incogni. Most of Europe, and especially the eastern and central ones that were close to Russia, viewed it as their number one priority in the last couple of decades to convince the US to extend their security umbrella over them and to thereby deter Russian aggression. These people called themselves Atlanticists, and the belief was that the more they bought from America, the more the US would be inclined to stick with them. This became especially prominent since the Russian invasion of Ukraine, to the point where now two-thirds of Europe's weapons imports are coming from the US, and European NATO capitals have almost 500 combat aircraft and many other weapons on order from the US. The poster child of Atlanticism is probably Poland, where until recently American approval rates were at an insane 93%, meaning that Poles probably thought of America more highly than the Americans themselves, and where the country not only spent a pretty bonkers 4.7% of their GDP on rearmament last year, but also explicitly chose to buy American gear like Abrams tanks, Apache helicopters, HIMARS and Patriot systems, and so on, even when for many of those weapons categories, European alternatives were very much available. Atlanticism also extended to allowing American tech firms to dominate the vast majority of Europe's IT infrastructure without much of a pushback, with the European Commission, for example, not only becoming one of the first government entities to move all of their infrastructure to Microsoft 365, but then even suing its own data protection board when they ruled that move illegal. All of this was based on pretty much the same assumption as Europe's former reliance on Russian gas too, a hope that if we just kept buying enough stuff from our trading partners, surely they wouldn't turn against us. In retrospect, that is obviously not how things turned out on either side. And now, with Musk straight up saying that America should leave NATO, with Trump explicitly claiming that America should only export weapons with downgraded capabilities to allies because those might someday stop being America's allies, and with the administration repeatedly saying that it wants to take land from at least three sovereign countries, it's clear that the race for European autonomy has to be on. So let's see how France achieved autonomy unlike the rest of us and what it would take for us to catch up, starting with the topic on probably everyone's minds, the military. Charles de Gaulle, the former president and general of France, famously viewed military independence from the United States as one of France's key objectives, saying that they wanted to be allies to the rest of NATO, not dependent on them. He pursued a largely independent weapons industry, including France developing its own nuclear arsenal by 1960, and 6 years after that he asked all foreign NATO military personnel to leave France's territories. France also made everything from its own fighter jets, its own aircraft carriers, its own submarines, its own tanks and infantry fighting vehicles, and pretty much every critical equipment for its own military. France is even the largest contributor to Europe's space programs, like Ariane, which just a few weeks ago launched Europe's first commercially successful rocket in years, carrying none other than a French military satellite used for high-definition imaging. Now, the country is not 100% independent. Many of its programs, like the aforementioned satellite, are made in collaboration with other countries, like Germany in this case. It also, for example, uses so-called AWACS airplanes from America, which are like gigantic, ultra-expensive flying radars, and it has even used US components in some of its weapons, like the Storm Shadow or Scalp cruise missile. This reliance then allowed America to block the sale of said missile to countries like Egypt, and it also allowed the US to place limits on its use by Ukraine. But as you might expect, limitations like those only further convinced the French to pursue more independence going forward, and the fact that France was able to achieve as much autonomy as it did on its own just as one country, and also while only spending about 2-3% of its GDP on its military in the last 40 years or so, is clear proof that Europe as a continent could have become a lot more independent if it had spent more in the past, and also hadn't consistently chosen to prioritize integration into an American-led alliance. By today, Europe has become critically reliant on the US military in three key ways. First, America is actually in charge of commanding and coordinating various NATO armies, even in Europe, so they could act as one force instead of, say, 27 national armies just in the EU. Second, tens of thousands of American troops are physically located in European bases who would act as a credible tripwire so that the US could credibly claim that at least an attack on a NATO base was an attack against itself too. Third, America provided many of the so-called enablers in NATO. These are the ultra-expensive, ultra-complex things like those AWACS airplanes that we talked about with France, but also most of the tankers for mid-air refueling, nuclear weapons of all sizes and shapes, and also ultra-advanced systems like the F-35 fighter jets, for example. These are all so expensive to develop and maintain that it historically made more sense for one program to span all of NATO instead of multiple competing ones, and the US was more than happy to be the superpower to be in charge of all of these. In fact, they got very angry when the French made their own nukes, for example. But with the team of Trump now explicitly saying that they want to stop supporting Europe going forward, we have to find credible alternatives for all of these going forward. This means building a European-wide command structure that works even if Americans choose to not coordinate. It also means hiring new troops to make up for the potential withdrawal of the Americans. And we'll also have to rearm ourselves in a way that we don't have to ask for American help or permission to defend ourselves. And here, I've got some good and some bad news, and I'll start with the good. Europe will simply not need to replicate every one of America's high-end capabilities, at least on the short to medium term. While America's military ambitions are to be an unchallenged global hegemon, including the ability to challenge China, an actual superpower across the world's largest ocean, Europe's primary objective, at least in the next 10 years, will pretty much just be to deter Russia. A country that in more than 3 years has not been able to overrun its own neighbor, a minor military power who started the war without a modern air force or a navy. While Ukraine has been given access to critical Western weapon supplies, the quantities were always severely limited and didn't involve any high-end equipment like the F-35s, and yet they still managed to hold on. In fact, they neutralized Russia's Black Sea Fleet, they largely pushed Russian airplanes out of Ukrainian airspace, and they forced the invasion of Russia to slow down so much that after the first few days of panic, you can now barely see the changes on a map. Russia should very much be taken seriously, and American help is extremely valuable, especially with things like satellite imaging, but at the same time, it's also true that European arms from the French Rafale jets to the Finnish Patria AMV, or the Swedish CV-90 to the German Panzerhaubitzer 2000, and so on, are often already world-class and easily good enough for this task, it's just that we haven't chosen to buy enough of them in the past, but this of course is in our power to change. Meanwhile, we also have the luxury that Ukrainians have already chewed through the majority of Russia's insanely large Soviet-era stockpiles of tens of thousands of tanks, artillery pieces, and more, while also having built up a world-class drone industry and more that we'll all be able to benefit from, too. Europe has already become the largest importer of arms since the war in Ukraine started, and has also announced record-breaking spending plans on top of that since, plus countries like Canada, Australia, Japan, and so on are all becoming very nervous about their extreme reliance on American weapons as well, so there seems to be a very large addressable market for our arms manufacturers to finally safely ramp up production. So the good news is that long term, I'm very confident that this can work. But the bad news, of course, is that we're not necessarily dealing only with long term timelines. The withdrawal of Trump might happen very rapidly, and in fact, we've already seen that he's willing to turn off already existing capabilities for Ukraine during an active war to force them to accept a favorable outcome for the US. Beside, many military experts now think that Russia has a big incentive to poke a NATO state, like Estonia, for example, with a limited-scale attack before we have time to comfortably rearm, to see if we would truly respond with overwhelming force with or without the Americans, and thereby risk going to a nuclear war. If we do, that's scary. If we don't, that puts the whole existence of NATO into question. Ramping up our own factories takes time, so short-term, we have no chance but to rely on American weapons, and maybe even to buy more of them, which is obviously a terrible dilemma. Now, thankfully, Europe does have kind of a solution, and that is to give overwhelming support to Ukraine to defend itself, because each day that they do so buys us more time to strengthen our domestic defenses and leaves Russia more exhausted. Supporting Ukraine is a European imperative, even from just a very selfish perspective. But if we get through the next couple of years unscathed, then our weapons industries should have time to scale up, and then we should be able of autonomous defense. Which brings us to our next topic, energy. Now, to avoid making this video like 13 hours long or something, I'll only be talking about energy in the perspective of strategic autonomy. There are other aspects to it, for sure, and those are important too, but in this video, I'll focus on autonomy. France realized right after the Second World War that strategic autonomy could only be achieved if the country also reduced its reliance on import-dependent fossil fuels. So they famously built the majority of their electrical grid around nuclear power, which is supplied by 57 operable reactors spread across the country that are also run by a state-owned firm called EDF. And while France also has to import most of its uranium, suppliers span Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Niger, Australia, Namibia, Canada, and more, which allows for great diversification, and nuclear fuel is so compact that it can be stored in strategic reserves, so the whole system is fairly resilient. If you look at all energy use, not just electricity, France managed to cover 50% of its demand with nuclear, renewables, and other sources that it can domestically produce, which is far higher than the EU average. The country does import fossil fuels, but mostly oil and coal, which are much less problematic for autonomy than gas, as they don't need fixed pipelines and can also be stockpiled long term. All of which is to say that while they're not completely isolated, France is once again remarkably autonomous. Meanwhile, in 2022, the year in which Russia's invasion was already underway for 10 whole months, the EU still got 70% of its energy from fossil fuels and over 20% from gas, which immediately led to pain. Russian gas imports collapsed due to sanctions, and while Norwegian pipeline gas was able to offset some of that, there was an even bigger jump in liquefied natural gas to fill the void. This is gas that is compressed and typically shipped in via massive specialized ships rather than pipelines, and looking at this chart, you can see that the United States is by far the biggest supplier of the stuff to Europe. The problem is that the new American administration is of course expected to use our newfound reliance on their energy imports as leverage against us too, and also that LNG is just inherently way more expensive than pipeline gas. Together with sanctions on Russia, this led to not only massive price jumps for gas, but also for electricity in Europe, since prices here are always based on the most expensive producers, which is now almost always the extremely expensive natural gas. Now, the good news is that overall gas imports and consumption have started coming down, and they're now at an 11-year low, while fossil fuel consumption in Europe in general is decreasing too. Accelerating this transition aggressively has to be a top priority for the continent's autonomy, and there are two things that have to happen. First, consuming less energy by electrifying everything, insulating buildings, enabling better alternatives to driving and flying, switching to heat pumps, etc. The less energy we consume, the easier the transition becomes. And second, a massive build-out of nuclear and renewable electricity generation. Each country will have to figure out which split makes sense for their particular case, but nuclear has some clear downsides in the specific situation Europe is in. While nuclear power plants do produce relatively cheap electricity once they're built, actually building them is incredibly expensive and takes ages. France's latest power plant took 17 years to build, by the end of which it was 12 years late and 4 times over budget at 13.2 billion euros. Meanwhile, Finland's most recent plan took 18 years to build, where it was 13 years late and 3 times over budget at 11 billion euros. And still in construction is Great Britain's Hinkley Point C, which is now estimated for a 2030-ish finish date, meaning a 20-year construction period if they actually make it on time. And the project is of course already twice over budget and is costing a mind-bending 41 to 48 billion pounds. The timelines of needing 20-ish years for a single plant from the point when a decision has already been made is just really difficult to square with the urgency of the problem that we have, and the massive upfront investment costs are a real burden too. As the head of the German energy giant E.ON put it recently, no private investor will ever invest in nuclear again in Germany, since costs have ballooned to pretty much untenable levels. This means that governments would pretty much have to foot the bill on their own, as they largely did in France, the UK, and Finland, which means hundreds of billions in upfront investments. Doing this while also having to massively ramp up military spending in parallel is simply not going to happen, and so while some plants will be built and will also be helpful long term, they won't account for the majority of the change in the short to medium term for sure. Thankfully, despite all the naysayers, the build-out of renewables is actually booming in many countries already, with Germany, for example, having gone from roughly 40 to 60% of its electricity production coming from renewables in just the last 3 years. And this growth is increasingly driven by private investments rather than governments having to foot all the upfront costs themselves, as the cost of solar, wind, and batteries all keep coming down. In terms of autonomy, it's also important to point out that Europe has highly capable firms in both nuclear technologies, but also renewables like wind power, where some of the clear market leaders are from the continent. Plus, we also have strong industries for trains, public transports, bikes, heat pumps, and many others, meaning that we can largely be self-reliant in this transition if we need to be. While we are behind China with batteries and electric vehicles, Trump's axing of Joe Biden's massive subsidies in green tech areas like these is a historic chance for us to lure these companies, scientists, and factories over here from America and to ramp up in this area. After all, Trump explicitly said that these are a green new scam, so he clearly doesn't want them. And while China has a stranglehold on solar, that is thankfully much less of a problem than fossil fuels, since the panels kind of just sit and produce electricity for years after they're installed, regardless of what their maker actually thinks about us. Of course, we have to learn from our reliance on America and mandate that the solar installations that we do have to be controllable by entities in Europe once they're bought. Once that is done, China flooding our market with affordable panels is mostly a net positive for our transition. Again, for autonomy, you don't need to be 100% cut off from the entire world. You just need to have enough control over things that are critical to you so that a bully can't come and bring you to your knees easily. With Norway as a reliable supplier of gas short term and the build out in renewables and nuclear long term, we're already moving into the right direction, but we need to accelerate these trends massively. While the American caricature of a patriot might be one driving a gas-guzzling pickup truck and insisting on drill, baby, drill, we need a widespread understanding that in Europe, a continent that imports almost all of its fossil fuels, our patriots are the ones who proudly take the train, insulate their homes, and switch to driving electric. Which finally takes us to our last topic, technology. I'll be honest, technology autonomy is probably the hardest part of the puzzle because of technology's tendency to create global champions and monopolies. I don't see a European champion unseating American chip giants at the high end. I have low hopes for switching from YouTube myself, and Europe is so far behind in so many areas that full independence is simply not realistic. That said, there is one area of technology where sovereignty is not only possible, but also really crucial. I'm talking about the IT infrastructures that most of our large companies and even government agencies are running on, which, more often than not, is basically some version of Microsoft 365 and Azure. As we've discussed with the example of the European Commission already, our entire continent has largely outsourced the storing and managing of all of their data, communications, and documents to American software giants like Microsoft, Google, and Amazon. Those, of course, keep pinky promising that we're totally still in control because they now have servers in Europe or whatever, but we really shouldn't be betting on this. The US Cloud Act was explicitly created to allow federal law enforcement to compel US-based technology companies to provide requested data stored on servers, regardless of whether the data are stored in the US or on foreign soil. So, a European government emailing itself via Microsoft, for example, is something that the US government can theoretically read and block if they want to. That is insane, and also something that we've actually seen in action being used as leverage already. Amsterdam Trade Bank, which is a Dutch bank owned by Russians, got hit by US sanctions, which resulted in Microsoft yanking the company's and staff's access to their email accounts, along with Amazon shutting off their cloud services too. Soon after, the bank simply went bankrupt due to not being able to function. The Dutch bankruptcy courts tried to unroll the bankruptcy, but Microsoft said, no, sorry, the US sanctions still apply, and so the Dutch had to actually sue them to release the data. Similarly, Trump also sanctioned the International Criminal Court in The Hague for a judgment on Israel that he didn't like, and he flirted with the idea of fully cutting off their access to their IT systems like Azure, where, quote, we essentially store all of our evidence in the cloud. That did not happen in the end from what I can tell, but the ICC got spooked enough to decide to review their suppliers and have taken steps to end some commercial relationships to reduce exposure to potential sanctions. In short, the US has already proven that they control the systems that our governments and our biggest corporations rely on, and fixing this should be our biggest priority. And while fixing this will require a lot of work, this is the one area where I'm actually the most hopeful. Russia has developed Astra Linux, which is their own government-managed Linux-based operating system that is paired with their own cloud and widely used in government circles and even state-adjacent enterprises like Rosatom, Gazprom, and the Russian Railways. China maintains a similar ecosystem for their sensitive workloads around what they call Kylin, which is based on Ubuntu, and the French gendarmerie built Zhenbuntu in 2008, which is their own Linux-based operating system that they claim they've rolled out to 97% of their over 100,000 workstations since. This is, of course, on top of other open source tools such as OpenOffice, Thunderbird, Firefox, and also domestic cloud solutions. The French government even started developing a full suite of open source software tools to replace Microsoft Office, Teams, Notion, etc. And while this is still in beta, I tried it and dare I say it actually looks really nice. Like, I bet many employees might prefer using these over the abominations that are Microsoft Teams and Outlook. Also, just recently, the Dutch government started to call for the same to happen in their agencies, and one of the latest adopters is the German state of Schleswig-Holstein, who recently started switching to open source tools as well. I actually asked them to see how it's going, and they gave me a super nice and detailed response, which I've linked to down in the description if you want to read it, but here are my highlights. They have about 30,000 seats which they want to migrate. Step one is migration from Office, SharePoint, Outlook, and Exchange, so basically the document and email management first. Then step two is ditching Windows, Microsoft Active Directory, and their telephony tools. They expect all of this to give them control over their own data, plus they also calculated savings of 6.5 million euros in licensing costs and the like in the next 10 years, and of course with a shift of their spending going from Microsoft to local IT specialists. Overall, they claim that the transition is going very well, especially for regular office work, but they've also found that for specialized software or for collaborating with other government agencies, the transition is harder, hence why they initially only target a 70% rollout by October. I think it is inspiring that a single agency can do so much on their own, but their limitations also highlight that I think perhaps a different approach is needed. Instead of each government entity individually needing to find, test, integrate, and manage a dozen different pieces of software itself, which then might or might not be compatible with the rest of government or third-party software vendors, we really need a Europe-wide system. Now, while in China or Russia this was achieved by the state literally building a centralized system for itself, I think in Europe, where we don't have such a strong centralized authority, we should pursue a different, more market-oriented approach. And I actually came up with a suggestion that goes like this. First, the European Union needs to put it into law that its own IT systems, as well as those of their member state governments, are critical infrastructure and that these need to be sovereign. This sovereignty shall be defined as only using software made by system vendors who only fall under European surveillance laws and whose code the government can actually audit. Those are completely reasonable requirements long term, and they would naturally include American giants like Microsoft. A clear deadline should be laid out for when to achieve all of this, including maybe a staggered rollout. So perhaps your word processor has to be compliant by year 3, then spreadsheets and video calling by year 4, email by year 5, etc., until all the critical areas are covered. And instead of the EU developing stuff themselves or specifically dictating which program has to be used, they should define clear standards for compatibility, like some governments have already done by enforcing open document formats for their agencies, for example. This kind of a rule ensures that agencies both remain compatible across one another, while also having the freedom to choose from multiple vendors. Better yet, this would also encourage private companies to actually compete for this massive new market, which has clear timelines and clear technical requirements. After all, governments are the biggest purchasers of IT services in the EU, and so serving this market would be a huge opportunity that private investors would jump on readily. If this was implemented correctly, then the continent might end up with its own tech giants, which would potentially also compete against one another, bringing costs down instead of the monopolists that we have right now, and all of this would be done without the government having to build its own software. Overall, I think strategic autonomy is at least theoretically possible in all the three areas mentioned above: core technology, energy, and military as well. But I'm of course also aware that none of this is guaranteed at all. Europe is already politically divided, loads of lobbyists will try to prevent any real change, a Russian ceasefire might cause all of us to let our guards down again, politicians might raise mountains of money but then choose to spend those on stupid vanity projects instead of actually fixing our issues, and European citizens of course might just vote for politicians who promise them that they won't actually have to pay for any of this in the first place. After all, the cost of autonomy is very much real. It'd be much cheaper to just pay SpaceX for a Starlink connection right now than it would be to design your own rocket, launch your own satellite, and maybe have a connection multiple years from now. That said, if we're smart, I think we also realize that these strategies actually have long-term strategic economic benefits. On top of our autonomy, we might also gain internationally competitive champions in defense, green tech, and software, which would create the basis for prosperity long-term. Okay, and if you're thinking that your government having its data stored by companies that might screw them is the problem, then you might want to do something about the same being true for your data as well. Check this out. This is an official data breach record of a company called California Cryobank that they submitted to the US government just a few days ago. Now, that is one of the world's largest sperm banks, and they've just lost the names, social security numbers, driver's license numbers, financial account numbers, and health insurance information of their customers to hackers. Oops. Or how about a company called National Public Data, who not long ago lost 2.9 billion records of private people, including their detailed profiles. Your sensitive data is a hot commodity that is being collected and then bought and sold by so-called data brokers online. They sell it to scammers who use it to personalize phishing emails at you, for example, or even to your government, which has admitted to buying data on its own citizens instead of bothering to do all the spying itself. But thankfully, my sponsor Incogni was built specifically to combat these data brokers. Because as it turns out, in these countries, at least, data brokers are legally required to delete your data if you ask them to. You can see that in my case, they found over 160 databases that I was in, and they have successfully removed me from most of them already. That is an insane figure. Now, of course, you could do all of this yourself, but it would require you finding all of those data brokers yourself, dealing with objections, and also periodically checking in with them to see if they haven't just added you back again after deleting you. That is just not practical for most people, but Incogni does all of this continually on your behalf in the background with a subscription. They support multiple email addresses and 3 physical addresses with a single subscription, plus they also have family plans. Now, the removal only necessarily works in places that have legal frameworks around this, but that is a pretty good selection already. To sign up, be sure to use my code TECHALTAR, that is TECH ALTAR, to get an exclusive 60% off an annual Incogni plan. That is incogni.com/TECHALTAR for 60% off, and I'll see you in the next video.